You are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. Makai Watch is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with Tahiti Nui, Heaven on Earth, and the Greenery Cafe.
Announcing the return of the Tahiti Nui's Hanalei Luau, featuring 50 years of songs and dances as a tribute to their mama, Auntie Louise. Tahiti Nui, providing live Hawaiian music on Kauai since 1963. This family-style luau is every Wednesday, 5 to 7:30. More information at 826-6277 or online at thenui.com.
Heaven on Earth starts here. Organically grown, GMO-free vegetable starts available at Hoku Foods in Kapa'a, Kauai Seascapes Nursery in Kalihiwai Ridge, and Saturday Morning Market next to Kauai Mini Golf. More information at heavenonearthstarts@gmail.com.
The Greenery Cafe in the heart of Lihue, one block off of Rye Street on Akahi Street, serving flavorful and organic soul food, wraps, smoothies, herbal iced teas, desserts, and vegetarian meals. Located in the lush garden setting near Tip Top Cafe, call-in, takeout, and catering available. Open Monday through Friday for breakfast and lunch. The Greenery Cafe, hearty, healthy soul. 246-4567 or online at thegreenerycafe.com.
Mahalo Tahiti Nui, Heaven on Earth, and the Greenery Cafe for supporting Kauai Community Radio.
Oh, we ain't got a barrel of money. Maybe we're ragged and funny, but we'll travel along, singing a song side by side. Don't know what's coming to tomorrow.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha. Welcome to Makai Watch, a program about the aina, defined as that which feeds us. This program focuses on information and opportunities for community involvement in the stewardship of our resources on Kauai and around Hawaii nei. Makai, toward the ocean, as all things flow to the sea and the sea is connected to you and me. If you're interested in volunteering for the Hanalei Makai Watch program, please contact us at 826-1985. The Hanalei Makai Watch program publishes the Hanalei Moon and Tide Calendar, now in its fourth printing. We hope you are enjoying your copy of the 2015 calendar. If you have comments about the content of our calendar, please let us know by calling 826-1985. My name is Maka'ala, and I'd like to thank KKCR for providing this program and Laura Christine for engineering it for us. We'll be happy to take your calls after we've introduced our subject for today. Please call us at 826-7771. Before we begin today, I do want to give a shout-out to the Waipa Foundation, Kaylin Kelekoma, and all the Waipa staff and volunteers who put on what I can only call an epic Mango and Music Festival yesterday in the Ahupua'a of Waipa. It is an extraordinary venue next to the Halulu fish pond that they are restoring, and the music is extraordinary. The food is amazing. The crafters are wonderful quality, and the educational opportunities there are definitely worth your attention next time. Their next event is usually in December. Will be the Taro Festival. So watch for that. And thanks, Waipa, for doing such a great job. Makai Watch van was there, and we were very pleased with the number of people who stopped by to talk about things Makai, things in the ocean. We'll be running our regular contest today, so listen for the question and win a prize. If you have ideas for future shows, please let us know. Okie doke, here we go. Today, we have Robert Wintner on the phone, and he is, I think I'm going to let him tell you who he is because he has a kind of a secret identity that all of you know, but I'm going to talk about him and introduce him as Robert Wintner for now. He's an author with wide-ranging subjects. His recent books deal with the lingering influence of the 60s, cerebral aneurysm, and of course, reefs. Reef Libre is an in-depth look at the Cuban exceptionalism and the last best reefs in the world. Aloha, Robert. Are you with us?
Aloha, Maka'ala. It's good to be here.
Ah, I'm glad you're there. Thanks so much for calling in. We're really glad we have that opportunity so people don't have to fly to Kauai just to do this show. And as you and I are talking today, we'll try to remember that we do have listeners internationally. We have listeners around Hawaii. So we don't have to be Kauai-centric in our stories and tales and concerns and issues. But we tend to focus on it just because we're sitting here on Kauai. You're involved in several efforts related to ocean and marine issues. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your involvement in reef stuff.
I think it comes from spending quite a bit of time on the reef, through thick and thin. You know, in life you have many tests and trials, sooner or later. And I've always had reef time, good times and bad times, and I've taken solace in reef habitat and reef critters, and they've given me quite a bit, and I think it's, you know, just the least I could do to give something back. It touches a nerve with me when I see people doing the wrong thing. You know, the Hawaiian word pono, it's always intrigued me. The definition is, of course, doing what is right, and it's according to what, according to who. But most of us know the difference between right and wrong when we see wrong in blatant examples. And I see it every now and then on the reef. I see it in many forms. Now, some forms I could be wrong. Other forms I'm not wrong. It's a wrong thing to do, certain practices. And so that's my motivation. I began serious work on reefs here on Maui on three issues. One was the gillnet campaign. And that was good timing. It began right at the tail end of Peter Young's office he was director of DLNR right at the end of his term, and he was very receptive. Now, the island of Maui is the only island in Hawaii with a total ban on gillnets, but the others are somewhat regulated. We still have incidental kill, and for a while they had incidental kill permits, which is pretty outrageous, because gillnets are killing endangered species, the turtles and the monk seals. But Maui has none, and it took us about 6 or 12 months to get that done. We moved on from there to water quality. I pretty much moved beyond water quality because there's a crew on Maui that is so excellent and proficient in the water quality campaign. I moved to the last item on the agenda, which was the aquarium trade. It turned out to be more formidable than I anticipated. You know, the aquarium trade reports between $1 and $2 million gross revenue from Hawaii. Well, we think it's about 10 times more than that, say 20 million. But it still palls next to the worldwide industry volume, which is $4 to $5 billion. And even though the Hawaii component is small, the Hawaii component is pivotal. Without Hawaii Reef Wildlife, they could not sell the tank stands, lights, filters, fancy displays, all that stuff, and it's huge. And so focusing on Hawaii is going to be, I think, vital to the campaign's success. I will remind you on Kauai that you do have a vital link in this chain, and that is there's not a big part of aquarium collecting done on Kauai, but there is a pretty troubling part, that is that the collectors come to Kauai for the more exotic species they can't find anywhere else. The more rare they are, the more valuable they are, and the more important they are in the ecosystem. So that's where Kauai fits into this puzzle. I'm not sure what else to tell you about myself. You know, it's very difficult to describe yourself in any format, so I hope that helps.
I'm going to out you then because you didn't go there. This is Robert Wintner's Snorkel Bob. So we have a Snorkel Bob on Kauai, and we all enjoy the caricature that represents Snorkel Bob. So he does have this whole credible persona of Robert Wintner, but then he's got this thing, this Snorkel Bob guy.
Yeah. It doesn't mean I'm schizophrenic. We actually have two Snorkel Bobs on Kauai.
Ah, sorry. Yeah, there's that whole south side of the island that I know nothing about.
Well, there's one in Kaloa. There's Kapa'a in Kaloa.
The Kapa'a one we drive by at a slow rate of speed, I might add, so we get to look at your store, you know, really well these days because traffic moves at about, you know, 2 past there if we're lucky.
Right. Well, as you can see, we began humbly, and we try to stay that way.
Yeah, it is a humble little store. It's a great little shop. Okay, so... So one of the things that happens with aquarium take in Hawaii is that there are permits, and I would probably agree with you without too much argument that they underreport what they actually take. But do we know how many permits there are? I mean, is there a lot of them, or is there a few folks that are taking a whole lot of fish?
There's a few folks taking a whole lot of fish. I don't know how many there are active. I'm guessing it's about 150, something like that. There are 50 who do it regular. 50 people. That's
wow.
It.
Wow. I remember once, actually it was with you many years ago, we went snorkeling up on the North Shore and you asked the question, so where are all your yellow tang?
Right.
And we looked at each other and went, actually, I don't know where they all went. Where did they go?
The great bulk of the catch is yellow tangs. That's their target species.
That's the thing, right?
So,
you know, I was in a restaurant the other day, and they had a saltwater tank, and they had some fish there, et cetera, and I kept thinking, I wonder if those are captive bred. Does anybody...
They're
just not.
Guaranteed they're not. Captive breeding is a very popular greenwash now. My tank is 50% captive bred. Well, my tank is 60% captive bred. If we do them, and captive breeding is these people who are taking wildlife, you know, we just had this episode with Cecil the Lion. Cecil the Lion was a personality, and so we got media around the world. He was no less of a personality than our reef wildlife, who are great personalities. And so now you have these aquarium hobbyists all over the world saying, but I'm partially captive bred. So I'm green. I'm conservationist. I'm ecologically concerned. And it's all hokum. Right now there are 2 million home tanks around the world. So if let's say they all go to 50% captive bred, then the hobby becomes acceptable. And there's 4 million tanks. And where are we? With the same amount of consumption with continuing declining habitat and wildlife in the wild. And I hope, Maka'ala, I'm not going to give you any grief, but I hope that when you go into a restaurant and see a saltwater tank, you take a minute and have a word, and it can be an aloha word, with management or ownership. Say, do you understand? These are not captive bred, and this is severely affecting a Hawaii public trust. And it's not pono. It is not harmless. Because that's one of the major steps when individuals can move beyond commiseration to verbalization. To targeted verbalization, and it doesn't have to be harsh. It doesn't have to be confrontational. Most people want to do the right thing. What's the alternative to a saltwater tank? There are tons of alternatives. There's closed-loop TV screens that are actually more interesting than a tank. There was a hotel here on Maui that we persuaded to take their tank down, and they're much better off. The fish they had inside were full of septicemia, that's fin rot from dirty water. They had a regular tank maintenance program with a pro, but the fish were dying. You know what a tang looks like with no fins? They're all rotted off. It's not pretty. The tourists come in and say, oh, that's a strange-looking fish. I guess that's what they have here. And it's not the case at all. It's a sick situation in Hawaii. It's not correct.
Wow. Wow. Okay, so that's something I certainly, since it's me, maybe I'll practice on the non-confrontational approach. But
you can try it in front of a mirror.
Yeah, I think I'll practice. I'll rehearse in the parking lot. But my question was, so if we know for sure that there aren't actually, you know, tanks somewhere that they are captive breeding, if we know that's a fact, then you know, it's much easier for us to broach the subject because we know that we don't
2%
have.
2% of all fish that you see in aquariums are capable of being captive bred. 2%. 98% of aquarium species are caught from the wild.
So even if they wanted to, they're not that successful anyway.
Oh, believe me, they want to. They can't do it.
They can't figure it out.
You realize how much it would be worth if they could captive breed yellow tangs? That's the bread and butter fish right there.
Yeah.
And there's only one. You see yellow tangs all over the Pacific and Indian Ocean, here and there, sporadic. But there's only one place in the world that has finger coral, and that's Hawaii.
And that's where they live.
You've heard about the stories about the Gold Coast on the Big Island.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
No other coast in the world, no other coral reef in the world has that much finger coral. And the yellow tangs were in the breaking surf. Now they call it the Gold Coast because of Michael Dell and Charles Schwab bought several lots there, each of them worth millions and millions of dollars.
Hmm.
I'm not sure that's what they were worth, but that's what they paid for them.
Robert, we have a caller that has a question for you. Laura, can we pull that caller? Did you have a question for Robert?
Hi. Hello, I did. So I've lived here in Kauai for over 30 years, and I've been diving for much of that amount of time, and on Maui as well, diving. And, 25 years ago when I really started diving, it was like diving into a pool of crowded fish and yellow tangs and humahumas and maninis and all of them, and to just sit there amongst them and watch them be so free, it was such an amazing thing. And over the years, I keep diving, and there are fewer and fewer, it seems. But if you then come out of the water and go into one of those restaurants and look at the fish in those tanks, there's such an incredible difference. They're miserable. You can just tell. You can tell they swim back and forth, and you can tell the anxiety. You can actually, if you really sit there and look at the anxiety on those fish's beings. And it's really concerning to me. And every time I see a tank, I say something to the restaurant owners in a pono, aloha way. But I think that what you're doing is a wonderful thing. And my question to you is, I know that in many parts of the world, those people that are collecting fish do small explosions in the coral to break the coral apart to get to those fish. Are they allowed, and are they doing that here?
Thanks for the question. It's a good one. You're correct. The fish in captivity tend to fade immediately. And they are miserable. And I will also tell you that the easiest fish of any species to breed in captivity is the anemone clownfish, the one now known, for better or worse, as the true Nemo. But after Nemo, clownfish were decimated in the Western Pacific because people wanted wild caught were so much more entertaining, meaning they were more agitated, they were more neurotic, they swam up and down, and the home hobbyists loved to see them move their fins that way. Then they all died. Now, in answer to your question, wait a second, I got off. What's the question?
we had to let her hang up because the line got some distortion on it. As I recall, she's interested in whether or not that they're allowed to blast the coral.
Oh, yes. There's so much that the aquarium trade has gotten away with over the years. Underwater has been under the radar, and they've gotten away literally with murder. As far as I know, they do not dynamite in Hawaii. The other hateful method they use for capturing fish is cyanide. They free dive with a little vial, maybe an ounce or so of cyanide, and they'll just open it on the reef. And cyanide, is pretty potent, and it will kill everything, stun and or kill everything in a wide radius, including all the coral polyps. And they stay dead. The reef remains a boneyard for many, many years. The fish are all stunned, and they float to the surface, and they pick them all up with nets, and about a third of them recover. And they put those in the buckets and ship them off for the aquarium trade. I don't think that happens in Hawaii. I don't know. There have been a couple of events in recent years over on Niihau where they were bleaching, using bleach the same way. Bleach is not, bleach is kind of like a bunker buster compared to cyanide, which is a nuclear detonation. I don't think they've used cyanide in Hawaii, but here's what happens. Anytime cyanide is used in those waters. For example, the Philippines and Indonesia are two places where they still use cyanide. Plenty of reef left for them. They still use cyanide. They're taking out sections of reef every day, killing the habitat and killing two-thirds of the critters, and the remaining, the surviving third, gets shipped off the aquarium trade. Any exposure at all to cyanide results in compromised liver function for fish and for humans. Most of the collectors over there have yellow eyes. That's jaundice from compromised liver function. The fish exposed to cyanide, especially in a direct manner like that, they have severely reduced lifespans. So let's say you're going to spend $50 retail on reef wildlife, and that fish is going to live, I don't know, maybe a year, if that, in your tank. Whereas if that same fish comes from Hawaii, you will probably get more lifespan out of it because of no cyanide in Hawaii. And the Hawaii trade cries cock-a-doodle-doo, we don't use cyanide. Our aquarium trade is a model for the world. And, you know, it's just hokum, it's bogus, it's not a model for anything but unsustainable extraction. They're saying the sky is green, it's sustainable, and it's not. They'll shape-shift at every opportunity. So the short answer to your question is no, I don't think they're using dynamite or cyanide in Hawaii. But the long answer is more complex, as is most things in this on this issue. And it's that, you know, they're making claims because they don't use cyanide. And they're taking more fish from Hawaii reefs, I think three or four or five times more than they're taking from the entire Great Barrier Reef. Australia's approach to reef management is completely different than Hawaii's. They're having trouble, too. Everyone's having trouble. This is easy. You don't take the wildlife. And if there was a guy, who was it? Our friend, you know him, Maka'ala. I think he was recently the chief administrator for DAR. I think he was the one who said it.
You mean Fraser?
Yeah.
Fraser McGilvray.
I want to attribute this to him. I think he was the one who said it. But at any rate, no matter who said it, I think it's true. If Hawaii was managed the same way as Australia, there would be one aquarium collector for all of Hawaii. But there's 50. And Hawaii is just a fraction the size of the Great Reef. So that's the long and the short.
And they don't do this because they're not making any money. I mean, they're making.
If it was $1 million divided by 50, that's 20 grand each, you would not see them out there with their torches and pitchforks screaming bloody murder. I'll kill you, you rotten sumbitch. You're trying to kill my family. I'll kill you back. And, you know, they wouldn't do it for 20 grand annual.
Right. And you're describing some of the, and I've been in the room, some of the reaction to proposed legislation and to proposed Hawaii State Board of Land and Natural Resource action and rules and proposed limits and so forth. And that's the... That is the level of the response that was in the room when I was there. It was clearly a profitable venture. What are there some places in Hawaii where the aquarium fishers cannot take fish?
Well, technically there are. Technically, 2% of all Hawaii near shore reefs are protected. 2%. That's fairly embarrassing right there. But the fact is, Willie Kaupiko from Mililii?
Yes.
Pretty colorful guy.
Mm-hmm.
And Willie's a much nicer guy than I am. And we were both at this hearing in Honolulu. This was during the Isla regime. You know, and I'm amazed that as many hundreds of times as I've announced that William Isla was, is, and shall be an aquarium collector, many people still don't know.
Yeah.
William Isla was vested in the aquarium trade, and he worked diligently in the best interests of the aquarium trade as he was director of DLNR. And we had this hearing, and William Isla, you know, the aquarium collectors in Hawaii are kind of at the bottom of the aquarium totem. When you go to the mainland, you get these guys who have PhDs in aquarium husbandry. Well, the guys in Hawaii are the grunts. They're getting $3 a fish. The fish retails for $50 or $150. These guys do all the grunt work. They work hard doing what they do, destroying reefs and taking all the habitat. But at any rate, Bob Hajek, who announced in public that Snorkel Bob is an eco-terrorist, was collecting aquarium fish in a protected area at Mililii. And Willie Calpico pulled up in his boat, and he saw the bubbles, he saw the aquarium boat, and he just waited. And here, bubbling to the surface, was Bob Hajek. Bob Hajek is president of the Kona Aquarium Scourge, or whatever they call themselves. And Bob Hajek sputtered, oh, honest mistake, no foul. I didn't realize I was over the line in the protected area. And Willie, being the Pono Aloha guy that he is, said, okay, now you can go back across the line where you belong. And Hajek left. A month later, Willie was out again, and there was Bob Hajek poaching. Is Bob Hajek the only aquarium collector who poaches? I don't think so. They go and get the fish where they need to because it's sustainable. It's money we're talking here. We need to make a living, do you mind? That's the whole MO of the aquarium trade, and the Hawaii version of it is pretty lowbrow.
Hmm. Interesting. What's the status of getting more legislation on the subject of controlling it better? Where is that? Is that at the ledge, or is that in BLNR? Is it both, or where are we with that?
As you know, we're on a biennial system. That means any bills introduced have a two-year life. So we introduced a bill last year. We felt like we had better alignment than ever before. I feel very proud that I think I had a part in unseating Neil Abercrombie. He was bad news for Hawaii Reefs. I felt good about David Ige. Now I'm not sure. He does not have what I think of as political will. I think unless we can, and my new book, don't get me started talking on this because I got so many other books to talk about, but my new book is about political will and how it is the be-all, end-all of anything we're going to accomplish in this world that is vanishing before us. And I'm talking about the world of nature. And if you live in Hawaii, it's the world you live in.
I look forward to seeing that one.
Sorry?
I look forward to seeing that one. That sounds like something that I would read.
Yeah, well, good. And it's got photographs. It's focused on Hawaii, the Philippines, and Komodo National Park in Indonesia. I would say to get something done in Hawaii, we're going to need political will and strong leadership, both inside and outside the government. We have approached the government, the state government, at three levels. You have executive, legislative, and judicial. Like I say, my hopes for David Ige were much greater than the reality has turned out to be. I think he's a very good guy. I think he's uninformed on this. We did meet with him, and he seems receptive, but there's a couple things in place that should be changed right away. Let me put it this way. The first time I met David Ige was a few years ago. I met him again on the campaign trail. I said, I want to thank you for running for governor, because if you hadn't done it, I was going to do it. And I think that you'll be better at it. But if I was governor, this would not be another round of footsies. It would not be another round of constitutional prognostication. It would be banned. And if you don't like it, you can bring a lawsuit. Well, David Ige is not quite there. Will he do the right thing? I think that there's a very fine balance between the executive and the departments. The executive, meaning the governor, wants to support his departments. The departments want to follow the executive policy. Does anything ever change? Very little. You know what rules and I'm going to make a distinction between the two Hawaiis. There's the state of Hawaii and there's the real Hawaii. I don't want to get, the kingdom people all lathered up, but, I'm with them on this issue. I'm with them on a lot of issues. But the state of Hawaii has always put money and power as top priorities. If you can consolidate power, consolidate money, it enhances prospects for reelection. And if you get reelected, you can do even more good in the world. But it turns to another round of footsies, hokum, how do you do, and nothing changes. Right now, We still need leadership either in the executive or the legislature. We saw some major disappointments in the legislature. We have some people there who are stand-up, stalwart warriors. What is the definition of political will? In a body like the Hawaii legislature, you see it in people who want to do the right thing, who have complete disregard for re-election. How often do we see that? Let me think here for a second. Well, that might take another hour.
Yeah.
You know, and you look at a place not that far away, Palau, where President Tommy Ramengasau Jr. put a rider on a banking bill, and the rider, it was a one-line rider, and the aquarium trade shall be banned forever. That's political will. I'm simplifying. He saw an opening, he moved in, and he took off the head. Boom. And they have no aquarium trade there. And will we get that? We need leadership. You know, this recent shakeup, I don't want to get into all the political intrigue, but this whole thing with DLNR director, by the way, Suzanne Case, we don't know yet what she's going to do. Naturally, it's natural. It's human nature to be optimistic, and so we're optimistic. We don't know. But, you know, all this brouhaha over DLNR director, first it was Carlton Ching. First it was Cardi Chang as interim, but he wasn't interim. He was just a figurehead. It was actually Alton Miyasaka who was acting DLNR director. And then the Carlton Ching thing, and Waterland chair in the Senate was Laura Thielen, and she came out against him. She was quite articulate and eloquent, I thought, made a case against him. He looked to me like a good guy. Frankly, I think I would have been okay with him. I think he's going to need some. He would have needed some green points, and this could have been the could have been made to order for him, the aquarium issue. But after all that, they got rid of Laura Thielen as chair of Waterland, the Senate. So who took her place? Mike Gabbard, a real ally, a real supporter, a very strong guy, a very Pono guy, who we really count on. And so he's Waterland chair in the Senate. We're going to be alive for the next round, but we still have some weak links in the House. I'm not going to name names just because we need to chat with these people and be nice, but they did what they did, and my reaction was, oh, man, you know, you just want to give them some backbone.
Yeah, for sure. We're going to take a mid-show break here and play a little music that thank you for providing. And you and I had talked about a quiz question, but we haven't gotten to the subject yet. So what I'm going to do is the quiz question will be, so how many estimated aquarium fishers are there in Hawaii? Because you've said the number a couple of times, and we're not going to say it again now, so don't help them. And we'll take a little break. It's a chance for you to get a drink of water or whatever, and we'll play the music, and then we'll be right back. The number for the quiz is 826-7771. get as long a break as we sometimes do, because we had a winner, and we thank you, Victoria, for calling in with the right answer, and Robin and I will sort out a prize for you with good dispatch. I have your contact information, and I'll be in touch with you. Robert, I want to be sure that we get to the subject of Cuba. Because it's fascinating to me, and I know that it's timely for a lot of folks who are thinking, oh, wow, I'd love to see Cuba nowadays. I'd love to see what's going on there. But frankly, when I think that, I'm thinking of the old cars and the bars and some of the villages and so forth, and it just didn't occur to me to be thinking about the condition of their reefs, but apparently that's something to see.
Yeah, all of Cuba is worth seeing, and you know, the Cuban countryside, the Cuban society, the Cuban culture really stands out among the Latin cultures because they're just so artistic, so smart, so expressive. And, you know, you go in there with a preconceived idea that it's a communist country with an iron hand, and it is. But the people are not shy. They will tell you what upsets them, what they don't like. They're so outspoken. We just loved it. You know, when I say we, I mean the Snorkel Bob expedition crew. We take trips really to reefs in many parts of the world. All the places I mentioned we've been to, and I saw something where, you know, reefs around the world are in decline. Everybody knows that. And there's one reef system that was recognized as the last best reef system in the world. For some reason, acidification isn't affecting it, and warming isn't really affecting it. And they have species there that are thought to be extinct, but they've been recently discovered. And reefs all over Cuba, if you get there, it's just mind-boggling. For example, we stayed the first night in the Copacabana Hotel. It got a remodel a few years ago. It's pretty dumpy. But you look out the window from the room, and you see coastline. You think of Hawaii in Waikiki, and it's, you know, it's really razzle-dazzle, circus-like. You look out the window there, and it's deserted. It's ghost town, and it's been like that for 60 years. And so we visited a reef right out front of the Copacabana Hotel. Now, you think, compare that to right out front of any hotel in Hawaii, well, especially on Oahu. And it's going to be, at best, you know, medium cool in Hawaii. There it was astounding. You know, I always like to use the example of Kaneohe Bay, where the aquarium trade took all the feather dusters because they were getting something like 35 cents each for them. They retail for $30. You know, historically, chump change is for chumps, and that's the position Hawaii is in once again. But in front of the Copacabana Hotel, there were hundreds and hundreds of feather dusters. There was biodiversity. There was coral cover. And that was our baseline. The real jewel in the crown in Cuba is called Jardines de la Reina. It's really the go-to place. That's the Gardens of the Queen in English. And so you have to take a seven-hour bus ride from Havana to this place called Jucaro. It's on the southern coast. And, you know, there's still strong ties with the Slavic countries, mostly the Russians. And you leave at 4 a.m. It's a real sleep deprivation marathon, believe me. And the Russians get on drinking, you know, vodka out of the bottle, and they're loud, and that's the first hardship, and the second is the seven-hour ride. But the Cuban countryside is unbelievable. This is all covered, by the way, in the book, Reef Libre, with photographs. The Cuban countryside is beautiful. They're still using handheld scythes to cut their grass. No weed eaters in Cuba. They still use donkeys and carts to go up the road. You will see no fat people in Cuba. They don't have that much to eat. Didn't meet one fat person in all of Cuba. And when you get to Jucaro, then you get on a boat. The stories are so rich, it's just unbelievable. Remember Robert Vesco?
Oh, yeah. Wow, there's a name from the past.
In the 1980s, he pretty much invented the American Ponzi scheme. And when he was indicted, he took $3 million in cash in a duffel bag and got on his boat and bounced around Central America and finally came home to his amigo Fidel. A few years later, he got indicted for behavior not good for the people or something. And he died in a Cuban prison a few years after that. But the boat he went down on, the Halcon, is now the liveaboard vessel you get on in Jucaro. This boat's 35 years old. It was a sport fisherman, but they've converted it to a dive boat. And you go down to Jardines. You're going down through the Gulf of Ana Maria off the south coast of Cuba. You go about 60 miles. It's another 7 hours on the boat. And you get to this mangrove estuary that rises up out of the middle. That is Jardines de la Reina, and it is surrounded by reefs. In a nutshell, 100% coral cover, 100% biodiversity. All the species ever meant to be there are there. And here's the biggie, a 100% host of apex predators. Mm-hmm. That means sharks. It means sharks, barracuda, big groupers, and moray eels. And we were, you know, we were excited. We got to the first dive site, and Manuel says, okay, very, very special place, not too many sharks, and we're all a bunch of macho guys, right? And we saw a dorsal fin break the water, and then another one, and then about 12 more, and we all look at each other, why are we going to get out of this perfectly good boat? And Manuel says, okay, go to bottom, do not hesitate, please.
Yeah, no kidding, do not hesitate.
And so we sucked it up, and we went. 3 days later, we were completely nonchalant. Now, I will grant you, these were reef sharks, usually silky sharks and Caribbean reef sharks. They're huge. They're like 10 or 12 feet long and probably 4 to 5 feet wide.
Oh, my
goodness.
They're
huge, and they're social. They swim among you. They circle you, as sharks do. They do figure eight. Sometimes they check you to see if you're still alive, if you're risk-free for lunch. And you check them back,
that.
You know, you give them a little nudge. They were knocking my camera strobes, but it was just phenomenal. We knew that we could run into bull sharks, tiger sharks, and hammerheads, and in fact we wanted to, but we did not see them. But they are there. But it was so rich. And I will say before I forget, you know, on the way back we timed it wrong. We timed 2 days in Cancun just to decompress. Big mistake. Cancun is gone. It's strip centers, shopping malls. It's loud. It's brassy. It's ugly. It's awful. We should have stayed in Havana Vieja, the old Havana. And you talk about old cars. There's not a dozen. There's not 100. There's not 1,000. There are thousands and thousands of them. They're everywhere. It's a point of pride. The bodywork is all straight. Might not be car show ready, and it might be some Bondo, might be some metal patches, I don't know. But it's all straight. They're all straight. It's a point of pride. Many of them, if not most of them, have been retooled with Russian diesel engines. Don't forget the Soviet influence there.
Mm-hmm.
And it is such a trip. It is such a show. It was one of the best outings of my life. It was so rich. It was nonstop. I would advise, if anybody can take it, it's expensive. A week in Jardines de la Reina. You have to commit for a week. The boat goes out on, I think, a Saturday and then returns on a Saturday, so you're there. And I think it was about $5,000 a person. That includes, of course, accommodation, meals, and diving. Worth every penny if you have it.
So what do you think is the main thing? I mean, we're thinking about this question before we went on the air. I was thinking, okay, so There's some pollution that they don't have, but they should have warming waters. I mean, there's the
well, they're isolated. It's a matter of prevailing currents and situation. The same way that Hawaii is somewhat buffered from climate change, just because we're sitting in the middle, and most of the warm currents are peripheral around the Pacific Ocean. So we get warmed last. We're getting some coral bleaching now, because it's been so many years and nothing's changed, nothing's being corrected. Hawaii is a little bit buffered, and so is Jardines de la Reina. And, you know, and I'll also point out, hate to kick this horse again, but I'm going to, Jardines de la Reina is completely unpolluted in every way except They now have lionfish.
Mm.
Lionfish are beautiful, incredible animals who are supposed to live in the Pacific and Indian Oceans, but the aquarium trade shipped them to the East Coast so home hobbyists could like them till the lionfish outgrew their home tanks and those people released them into the ocean. And now the aquarium trade says, we didn't do that. Well, the lionfish didn't swim there.
And they didn't fly. So are there things that we're concerned about here? I mean, with our coral reefs and so forth, are there golf courses? Are there herbicides? What is the land-based pollution?
It's all of the above. The golf course runoff is obscene, and it should be. You see these guys in their little golf carts with the giant Monsanto products in tanks on the back. It's blue. That's Roundup.
Do they have those in Cuba?
Oh, no.
No. Okay.
They got nothing in Cuba.
So,
you know, it's such a fascinating story. When the embargo started, and everybody's had a crash course since we're now normalizing relations, when the embargo started, it ended all shipments of American pesticide and fertilizer to Cuba. Fidel's response was, okay, all produce in Cuba is now organic. And it is. The reefs tell the story. If you're doing anything wrong on land, reefs die. That's why I make a distinction between old Hawaii and the state of. The state of defers to money and power, the end. Golf is money. We need this on our golf courses so the greens can be ready for prime time. And I mean that literally.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wrong. It's real wrong. I'm not sure what alternative will ever come into play, but I see these guys in their golf carts with the big plastic tanks of Roundup just squirting it like no tomorrow, 100 yards from the ocean. What are those reefs going to look like? Well, they're going to die. They are dying.
So one of the things that I think about when we identify a place that is as near as to pristine as we know, a place that that might be a teaching model, a place that is an example, two things come to my mind. One is, for heaven's sakes, let's protect it and try to, you know, conserve it and try not to impact it too badly. And the second is, what can we learn from it? So, you know, to identify, to have people going down to Cuba and identifying, you know, what's there and what's not there and use it as a teaching model. And I in my world, it's probably a good thing. It's expensive to get there because then they won't be overrun with, you know, those.
Well, yeah,
I'm
always hesitant to recommend a destination because
sure.
We know what happens. But I didn't hesitate on this one because, A, it's expensive. B, it takes a long time. Well, most people won't be coming from Hawaii. For us, it was 25 hours just to the Havana airport.
Well, the seven-hour bus ride with drunken Russians got me. That's not going to be...
Believe it or not, after that torture fest, about an hour after sunrise, we stopped at this little, really humble roadside. It was a gas station. It cost you 25 cents to take a whiz, but worth every penny because the attendant has toilet paper.
Aha! Uh-huh.
And also has a reserve stall with a seat.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, a rare thing.
But then they also had a latte machine. Who'd have sunk?
No kidding.
Talk about a little cup of joy.
Yeah.
It was more fun than I've had in many years. And the big question is, what will happen now? Well, there's already a growing wave of Americans who want to go for all the things I'm talking about. I made a few friends down there. One is the guy who was the director. He was a dive guide at Jardines for many years, and then he was supposed to clean up the reefs at Cal Largo. Now he's been transferred back to Jardines, and we stay in touch. And I've chatted with him. I sent a copy of Reef Libre to Barack and Michelle. Got a thank you note. Very nice. And
listen,
I suggested
to you, Barack and Michelle.
Huh?
Listen to you, Barack and Michelle.
They're not personal friends, but Maisie.
No, I love it.
Yeah, Maisie helped.
Ah. Good.
So, you know, it's good to have friends.
Of course.
And in the inscription, I said, thanks for all you do. And would you please ponder, using your influence, I know you're not directly involved, but using your influence, to consider Jardines de la Reina as a World Heritage
Site.
Yes, if it gets that status, it's protected. So I'm in contact with my friend Fausto de Neve Herrera. We went around and around jousting between communism and capitalism, and we're friends. And he's writing a book also, and he sent the idea to me for my opinion. He wanted to make a book about Cuban ingenuity. For example, if you don't take underwater pictures, this might not mean much to you, but if you do, it's just amazing. He got an old Canon housing from, you know, years ago, and he retooled it, engineered it to suit a not so old Nikon camera. It's astounding because the buttons are all wrong and he made them work right. And so he wanted his book to be about that kind of Cuban ingenuity. Well, for example, on the Halcón, it's 35 years old and it's a plastic boat, and they had to keep the thing really working to make it work. And I said, I have an idea, Fausto. Your idea of Cuban ingenuity is good, but why not make that a secondary idea on what's entailed in getting to where you want to go? And where you want to go is a World Heritage site for Jardines de la Reina. Now, and I told him about, you know, Barack and Michelle, and I said, you know, they're not involved directly, and neither is Raul for that matter. But what a great chance for a handshake across the water. You look at the political pluses. They're huge. The political negatives, nothing. And if they could use, if they could join up in asking for World Heritage Site status for Jardines, what would that be worth? He says, I love that. I love that. Well, it was obvious. It was right in front of him. He was so close. And so maybe he'll do that now. He's there at Jardines working. And that's where we are. We were motivated to go before the wave of tourists. And the book opens with the line, you know, that it's a common belief, common saying that when you travel to an exotic place, you want to get off of the beaten path. We wanted to stay on the beaten path. We wanted to see where the beaten path is going to lead. What's going to happen when tourists come? I said to Fausto when I was there, I said, you know, if this was Hawaii, I would come to you and I would say, this place you got, this Jardines de la Reina, you're now serving 1,000 guests a year. It's nothing. We need to take that to 30,000, and I can show you how. I can build condominiums, and when I'm done, these reefs not only won't be harmed, they'll be even better. And he chewed on that for about 5 seconds. Pretty smart guy. He says, that won't happen. I said, why not? He said, because we will fight. I said, we'll fight with you, brother.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that made us friends.
Yeah. It's a great story, and I hope people will get the book. Not that I'm your agent. You don't need me, but
I do need you.
but it's an opportunity for us to see what things could be. You know, certainly for the places that we have been impacting on the land, it's a stretch and it's work and it's hard and it'll take time. But it's good to have the picture in your mind of what could be. One of the things that I'm very concerned about here in our nearshore communities, both underwater and above, are shifting baselines.
Oh yeah.
What our grandparents saw, get what they said, get plenty fish. What our parents see when they say get plenty, what we see when we say get plenty, are completely different pictures. And people, you know, even here, even out in Hyena, when people come and they see the fish and they're, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And we have elders in Kupuna out there that say, this is nothing. This is nothing. This is gone practically compared to what it was. So the notion of, and it comes on you slow, you know. It's not something that you're even really aware of until one day it's gone. So
right.
These
it's
places
intended to be slow. When I hear the word sustainable, I'm very suspicious.
Yeah,
it's hokum. There's a huge difference between sustainable and abundant. The word and here's the key right here. The word abundance appears in several Hawaiian prayers, and right now on Hawaii reefs, it's gone. It's been taken.
Mm-hmm.
And it needs to it needs a chance to come back.
Well, I hope before the next legislative session opens, that we'll have a chance to have a chat about the proposed legislation, so folks can support or learn more about it and then support.
Yeah, I'll tell you the big challenge. We have no problem generating moral support and commiseration, but at crunch time, when it's time to stand up and testify, the aquarium crowd comes out en masse. This is their job.
Mm-hmm.
And they scream bloody murder.
And they're a scary bunch. I've been in the room. They're a scary
bunch.
Yeah,
and we get emails saying, gee, best of luck with this. I'll be working. And you know, and that's reality in the world, not just Hawaii, but in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's tough. It's tough to get people to step forward and say, this must stop.
Yeah. The designation of World Heritage, I believe, also brings with it the responsibility of not just being the example, but being the teaching tool, being the place that that we look to for a goal, you know, for
yeah.
this is what could be. Robert, we do have a caller. Aloha, caller, you're on the air. Do you have a question?
Aloha. Hi, Robert. I went to the proposed expansion of the Humpback Marine Sanctuary business, and I am against it. What are your feelings about it?
I have not read it, and so I'm not sure why I would be against it. I'm generally in favor of expanding any kind of sanctuary or protected area.
Yeah, I think
I don't know if that offers you any insight.
Well, it's a very large tome of a document, that's for sure. It's 600 pages of stuff, and for us on Kauai, it was very controversial.
Yeah, 600 pages sounds federal.
Yeah, well, it is federal, and it includes the EIS, and it also includes a whole lot of, you know, other data and information. But it's a very complex issue, and at some point it would be good to sit down and go through it. Thank you, caller. I really appreciate that question. I think I'm hoping that folks will be thoughtful about the alternatives and the possibilities of that proposal, because doesn't have to be cut and dried. It doesn't have to be black and white. But
yeah,
we clearly have to take advantage of whatever opportunities we have to conserve and preserve. And
what needs to happen when the federal government puts out these 600-page tomes, they need to put out the cliff notes, a 6-page version.
Yes.
Yes.
And the one thing I will say, and with no apologies, but deference to the hardworking state employees that especially at DAR that I know we have, the fact is that for those communities who have asked to be included in the sanctuary, the reason is that yes, it's in state waters, but the state hasn't been managing them. So that's been the motivation for most of those proposals, is needing more information, needing the resources that another government entity might be able to offer. The system in Cuba, as I understand it, is sort of, you know, mono style. They have one system and that's it, right?
Well, you know, they don't have to worry about those pesky committee hearings and all.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. Or the voters particularly, right?
No, and that is correct. And everything is enforced by the Coast Guard, and sanctions are severe.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It comes out one day, it's enacted the next, and you just do not mess with it.
So one of the options is, of course, communities doing what Haena is trying to do, which is to manage their place themselves, and saying, you know, it gets
no better than that.
Yeah, it gets no better than that, and that's the start, and we have a start, and we're hoping to make it a successful model as well. It would be wonderful. I know we were able to send some of the Haena folks around the Pacific, and I know they went to Fiji and a few other places to see some of their marine resource management. It would be wonderful fun to let them see Cuba.
Fiji has the best of it and the worst of it.
Uh-huh.
Just from what I've heard and what I've seen, the aquarium trade is there, and it's rampant and it's obscene on the one hand. On the other hand, there are communities in Fiji that have community sharks.
Yeah.
And they're doing great things.
Yeah, yeah. I want to thank you, Robert. This has been This has been great, and I hope we get a chance to do it again, since it's not too painful yet, a call in from your own living room or your own home office.
For you, Maka'ala, anytime.
Oh, be careful what you wish for. Aloha, Robert, and I'll be in touch. Mahalo.
Mahalo to you and ahui ho.
Ahui ho.
Aloha.
We ain't got a barrel of money. Maybe we're ragged and funny, but we'll travel along.
So we thank you folks for listening in today and for and for a good show again. I do want to mention, too, I didn't talk to Robert about some of the other things that he's involved with. A conversation with Robert can be a six-hour event, as I think you can probably tell. But thank you all for your support of Makai Watch. And if you want to be a volunteer, please call us at the Watershed Hui, 826-1985. And if you have ideas and comments and you want to talk about something different on this show, let me know. I'm happy to do that. And I thank KKCR and Laura Christine for engineering for us and for passing me little notes that say things like, and the next show, the second Monday of every month until she convinces me that I actually have time to come in more frequently than that, which I, at this moment, don't have. Aloha. Ahui ho.